Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padre Greedy, Richard Sanderson and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms, this week hosted by me, Padraig Reedy, and Neil Denny.
I will hand over to Neil Denny to introduce our guest this week.
Thanks, Padraig. So, Lewis Dartnell is an astrobiologist with a PhD from COMPLEX, which is the Centre for Mathematics and Physics in the Life Sciences and Experimental Biology at UCL. And he's currently working in the Centre for Planetary Sciences, researching in the field of astrobiology and the possibility of microbial life surviving in the surface dust of Mars in the face of the constant rain of radiation from space. He has won 3 national prizes for science writing, and his articles have appeared in the publications such as The Daily Telegraph and The New Scientist. Lewis is the author of Life in the Universe, A Beginner's Guide. So, Lewis, thank you for joining us on the platform today. Simple question, first of all, what is astrobiology?
In a nutshell, it's the search for life beyond Earth. It's this new emerging field of science trying to understand as much as we can about life on Earth and the conditions it arose under, the processes that got life started, and the kind of extreme ranges of conditions that life survives under now. And then extending beyond what we can find on Earth to look into the possibilities that might exist beyond the Earth as well, to look for extraterrestrial or alien life.
So moving on a little bit from that, and slightly bigger, more complicated and philosophical question perhaps, what do we mean by life? Clearly there's a difference between an intelligent, space-faring, cattle-bothering sort of civilization and microbes or something.
A probing form of life.
Indeed. Yeah. So what sort of criteria are we talking about?
I think that's... I mean, it's a very, very good question, and it's a very important question, and it's a question we don't really know the answer to. We can describe what life looks like and what it does on Earth, but a description of something isn't really a definition. Mm. But if we're looking for the kind of true essence, the universal thing that all life on Earth has, it has information, it has an operating manual, it has a book in some way codified inside it, so it can repair itself or grow or divide and replicate. It has, alongside that information, it has a system of very, very complicated network of chemical reactions, of biochemistry. You need to be able to power yourself somehow from your environment as a life form. And thirdly, all life on Earth is cellular. And that means it's got a bag or a sack around it just to stop all these other giblets from floating away. You've got the information bits and the kind of biochemistry bits, the metabolism bits, all very close together and kind of held in this oily membrane of a sack. That's as kind of universal definition of life as you can get. It's far from perfect, but it's a kind of working definition, if you like, for the kind of chemistry we're going to go look for on other planets.
So what sort of conditions are generally regarded as being sort of vital for life to get a foothold? I suppose let's perhaps talk about Earth first of all. So, what conditions need to be there when, Earth was first forming for life to take a hold? And obviously, presumably, that can give us insights into life on other planets.
Well, in terms of habitability, the kind of environment you need, the checklist you need to be able to tick off that could be a habitable environment for the origin of life is, first and foremostly, you need water, liquid water. You need a solvent to dissolve a lot of chemistry in and get it running and kind of support a cell. You need an energy source. As I said a bit earlier, life needs to kind of be able to power itself and drive its chemical reactions. So things like sunlight is a very good power energy source. It powers most life on the surface of the Earth. And you also need a particular kind of chemistry, organic chemistry, chemistry using carbon atoms as your kind of connector kit, your kind of Lego kit, because carbon is very, very good at building big, complicated molecules like DNA or protein that you need to build life out of. So as long as you've got those three things, these are the kind of basic prerequisites for life: water, carbon chemistry, an energy source, then that is a kind of habitable environment as far as we can define it.
So in terms of the old saying, talking about space, brilliant, because there's so much of it.
It's big.
In terms we can kind of understand, you know, we get stories every so often of, you know, there seems to be something that might be water on Mars or on one of Jupiter's moons, something.
Yeah.
Are you working on the idea that there is a possibility within the solar system we have of something being there?
Yeah, so there's a number of places, a number of habitable niches or potential abodes for life that we're interested in the solar system. And Mars, you've already mentioned, is one of them. It's the most Earth-like planet in the solar system in many respects. And we know for a fact, it's beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Mars has got water in it. It's got great big sodding ice caps of water, just like the Earth does. Problem with those is that they're solid water, they're ice. And we need liquid water, we need warmer water, wet water, for chemistry and kind of life to be able to run in it. But if you start looking back from what we can tell about Mars's history, when life was first getting started here on Earth, so billions of years ago, 3.5, maybe 4 billion years ago, Mars seems to be in a much, much more Earth-like place. We know for a fact that it had seas and lakes and rivers of water gushing across its surface.
Would that have been because the sun was hotter?
Actually, the sun was colder. The sun's been steadily brightening over its lifetime. And the thing that will wipe out all life on Earth in perhaps a billion years, long before the sun turns into a red giant, the thing that will wipe out all life on Earth, even the kind of life living kilometres deep in the crust, the thing that will drive the entire planet to extinction is a steadily brightening and hottening of the sun. So there's actually a bit of a paradox. It's something we don't quite understand yet, that the sun's got about 75% brighter and hotter over its lifetime. So we can't even really explain why the Earth had oceans of liquid water when life was getting started, let alone Mars, which was further away. It's called the faint young sun paradox. And we're trying to understand what kind of extra insulation the Earth might have had in terms of greenhouse gases to have kept this blanket around it and kept it warm and habitable and wet rather than kind of frozen over. So yeah, we're interested in Mars, and the other place you just mentioned was Europa, which is one of the moons of Jupiter. And again, we think that there's an ocean of liquid water beneath this frozen icy shell of Europa, possibly hosting the kind of life that we find deep in Earth's dark depths of the oceans here.
For the first half of the show, let's stay firmly
rooted
to Earth. Yeah. we'll look more closely at particularly Mars and Europa, if that's in the second half. You mentioned this idea of a energy source, which is one of the key things, and it seems pretty obvious that a key energy source that everybody will be familiar with is the sun. So most of the life that we're familiar with, it gets its energy from the sun. Now, there are, of course, places on Earth where there isn't any sun, and yet life has been found.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some of these ideas of the extremophiles.
So, yeah, there's a whole category of life forms, of organisms on Earth called extremophiles, that live in very extreme or hostile or just nasty environments. And some of these, for example, would be right in the bottom of the ocean. So we find, in fact, we only discovered them in the late 1970s, these so-called black smokers, which are great big chimneys pumping exceedingly hot, scaldingly hot water into the dark depths of the ocean, where they've been heated in the hot crust of the planet and dissolved lots of minerals, things like iron and sulfur. And this water jets out into the very cold, dark seawater. These kind of minerals precipitate out. It looks like great big columns of smoke being pumped out from the seafloor. And around these black smokers are veritable oases of life, stuff that we simply did not expect to find down there. So we see things like giant clams and fish that are bright white because there's no sunlight down here, nothing can see. But we also find these really weird life forms that were completely and utterly new to science. When they were discovered in the late 1970s, and they were given the name just kind of tube worms. They're worms, they look like a tube. And these things have bright red heads, and for the same reasons that our blood is bright red, it's got hemoglobin in it that can absorb gases like oxygen out of the seawater. And these worms, when they're first discovered, they have no mouth and they have no stomach. It's an animal that we couldn't even work out how it fed to survive. It was a complete mystery for a couple of years off these, for all intents and purposes, alien organisms were discovered in our own oceans. And it turns out, when you kind of look into it a bit more deeply, that these tube worms survive because they have inside little pockets of extremophiles, of what are called chemoautotrophic bacteria or archaea, so things that can eat chemicals. These bacteria can feed themselves by eating iron and sulfur and reacting these kind of inorganic ions together. They're eating kind of geochemical energy from the Earth's crust. They don't care about sunlight so much. They don't care about, you know, organic molecules like starch or carbohydrate or proteins that we have to eat from, you know, steak or our breakfast cereal. These things and the worms that depend on them would be quite happy if the sun were to blink out of existence tomorrow, until the oceans froze over. But
I was glad that you brought that concept up, because I was sort of dreading attempting to pronounce that process.
Chemoautotrophy, yeah. Indeed. It's a mouthful. We love long concatenated Latin phrases like that.
But there's obviously been forever an idea in popular imagination that there might possibly be life on other planets or something. But clearly, you know, this was a huge imaginative leap when these things were discovered, wasn't it? The idea that these have given a great boost to the idea that life could exist in extreme environments elsewhere.
No, it absolutely was. And it's with the case with these extremophiles, they're turning up in more and more places where we hadn't even been bothered to check for life. The received wisdom, obviously nothing can survive in this boiling hot pool of acidic water, so let's not even bother looking. And as this realisation increases that actually life is bloody nifty, it can adapt and evolve seemingly to pretty much any moist niche on the planet. There's very few completely sterile wet environments on our planet. Life is very tenacious once it gets started, and it can adapt into all these different environments. And so in one sense, that makes astrobiologists very, very confident that we could find life on other worlds, that even if the world isn't particularly Earth-like and it's got quite a hostile environment, extremophiles from Earth could survive there. But actually, the bigger question is whether life could have got started in the first place. We know that extremophiles can survive horrible conditions, but that's only once life has got started in the first place and then evolved. And we don't really know what conditions life on Earth got started under. Mm-hmm. So it might be that extremophiles are a bit of a, you know, kind of a distraction, a red herring, and we should probably just maybe ignore them and work out first what conditions life can get started on, or what range of conditions different kinds of life could get started on, and maybe then look for those conditions on other planets. It's a wide open field. This is, you know, right on the brink of modern science. There's a lot around this subject we don't know yet.
You're listening to Little Atoms. Our guest this week is Lewis Dartnell, an astrobiologist. I'm just fascinated by this topic because it's something I know very little about. So you mentioned, we have under the ocean, we have these tube worms on the ground, volcanic, the kind of clouds. Where else on Earth would be somewhere that, as you said, you wouldn't even think of looking? Would there be what other kind of environments?
So one of the kind of like poster boys, if you like, of extremophiles was discovered a couple of decades ago in these really hot geothermal pools in Yellowstone Park. So it's a region of the Earth where the crust is very thin. There's a big plume of magma just beneath the surface. It's essentially the crater of a super volcano in Yellowstone Park. And so you find lots of volcanic lakes, ponds of water that are very, very hot, near boiling, and also very, very acidic. And these kind of environments would kill. If you were to try and take a swim in this lake, it would kill you exceptionally quickly. You would boil to death. But these lakes are very, very colourful. They're full of kind of vibrant reds and oranges and yellows. And these are the colours of life in these volcanic ponds, of acidophiles, of acid-loving organisms, and thermophiles, heat-loving organisms. And actually, some of these organisms have really opened up our eyes to the extreme range of conditions that life can survive on. And they're actually making a lot of money now, that the kind of enzymes, the kind of molecules that these cells use to survive in this environment are very useful industrially or in the labs. So a lot of genetic engineering and molecular biology is based on the polymerase chain reaction. It's the kind of linchpin of a lot of genetic engineering. And the enzyme you use for that, or one of the enzymes, has come from these extremophile bacteria thriving in boiling hot acidic pools of water in Yellowstone Park. So there's a great crossover between kind of industrial process and biotechnology and extremophiles and origins of life and search for life on other planets. It's a very broad kind of multidisciplinary area.
So your own area of research is in looking at whether or not microbes would be able to survive on the surface of Mars under sort of intense radiation bombardment. And it's probably not taking too much of a leap to suggest that you haven't actually been to Mars to be able to do this.
I've yet to get my field trip.
So let's talk about ways in which, you know, how are you carrying out that research here on Earth.
Sure. Well, there's a list of so-called analog sites, places on Earth that are Mars-like in some respect. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I won't get your hopes up, they're not that Mars-like. because they're still pretty warm in comparison, pretty moist and wet, lovely thick atmosphere and oxygen and stuff. But there's places like the dry valleys in Antarctica, which are some of the coldest, driest deserts on the surface of the Earth, where I've been isolating bacteria. The kind of bacteria, the kind of extremophiles that can survive there, have got the right set of survival skills to survive on the surface of Mars as well. And another analogue site that's often used for research is the Atacama Desert, where I was out a month or two ago. And this, again, is incredibly desiccating, incredibly dry, although quite hot and then very, very cold at night. So you get these wild temperature swings. And it seems actually that in the very core of the Atacama Desert, it is very, very difficult to spot any sign of life whatsoever. It may be one of the very few patches of sterility on the surface of our planet, that it's a hole on the Earth where it's not habitable. Mm-hmm. That even the hardiest extremophiles can't make their living in this very, very cold, very dry, very energy, kind of organic, energy poor area. So testing those regions of the Earth for life and testing our instruments that we would then launch to Mars to look for signs of life is a good kind of testing ground. It's the kind of place that people send their robots to drive around and practice what you would do on Mars. It's an incredibly kind of extreme and rugged type of environment and landscape.
So let's sort of carry this on then. So if we're looking at, you know, the surface of Mars, what, you know, this tell us about what this intense radiation bombardment is actually doing to any possible microbes that might have been there.
So these are called the cosmic rays. Some of these are spewn off by the sun. Every time there's a big solar flare, the sun kind of spits out a great big pulse of particle radiation. And alongside that, there's at much lower levels, but much, much higher energy. So these are actually pretty nasty. Particles that have been accelerated by supernova through exploding stars throughout our galaxy. So there's this background level of radiation pervading and permeating our solar system and the galaxy as a whole. And the only reason we're protected from this cosmic radiation on the surface of the Earth is we've got a whopping great big atmosphere above our heads to kind of soak it up and absorb it and shield us, and a kind of deflector shield surrounding our planet, the Earth's magnetic field. But Mars has neither of these. It's got a very, very thin veneer of an atmosphere and no global magnetic field anymore. So if you're a microbe, a Martian bacterium on the surface of Mars, or actually if you're just a human astronaut, when we get our stuff together and finally get around to sending people to you know, plant flags and footprints on the surface of Mars, they're going to be exposed to very nasty radiation levels from the cosmic rays. So you can recreate these cosmic rays in the lab here on Earth at particle accelerators or using radioactive sources such as cobalt-60, which is something I was using a couple of weeks ago, just nuking the crap out of these bacteria that I've grown up from the lab after isolating from Antarctica and just seeing how many of them survive under different conditions. And then trying to piece together from that how long something on Mars might be able to survive when you're recreating those environmental radiation conditions, or how deep under the surface would something have to be shielded enough to survive until today that we could land a probe or a human there to kind of dig it up and find it.
So this is where I was going to next. I mean, if not the surface, if the surface has become, you know, so sterile and unable, where else on Mars?
Yeah, we need to look beneath the surface, under the surface, to kind of peel back the Martian soil and dig underground or drill underground and find what's there. And hopefully, within a metre or two of the surface, there's life that's been dormant and kind of soaked up a bit of a beating from this cosmic radiation, but has clung on and is still alive and persisting, that we could dig up and kind of reanimate and wake from its dormancy and get to know, kind of experiment on and scrutinise. Or maybe even deeper, kind of kilometres deep, there's life that's not dormant and cryopreserved, but is active and alive in the warmth of the crust of the planet, where it's a bit warmer and wetter. And we've actually possibly already discovered signs of a deep biosphere on Mars. We've seen plumes of methane gas seeping out of the ground in exactly the same regions where we think there's subsurface ice. And so that's a very, very exciting discovery, because one of the best explanations for methane seeping from Mars, where we see no other signs of volcanic activity or any geothermal activity, is it's biogenic. It's been produced by living organisms. So it's an exceedingly exciting but kind of tantalising. It's just the first step.
So a couple of weeks ago, we had the science writer Michael Brooks on the show, and I don't think we actually discussed it in the show, but in his book, 13 Things That Don't Make Sense, he talks about the Viking probes and this sort of confusion that happened in their various experiments that they did. And basically that for a few moments, they did think that life had been found, and then it was sort of all thrown into sort of
absolute confusion. But there's people that have maintained till today, and not just the people that design those experiments, but there's a cohort that's got a following that have maintained for the last 30 years that Viking did discover signs of Martian life, that the experiments worked as designed, and they gave us a positive result because there was life there. And actually, there's a new piece in the puzzle. There's been a new development in just the last month or two, with the Phoenix lander 2 years ago discovered that the Martian soil was rich in perchlorate. Mm-hmm. And what happens if you take Martian soil and heat it up exactly as the Viking landers did to look for organic molecules, the building blocks of life, is that perchlorate becomes exceedingly reactive and destroys and degrades any organic molecules that might be in there. So the two ways we look for active life both shows positive. When you look for organic molecules, you get a negative test, but it looks as though a very good explanation for all of that is perchlorate in the soil that destroys those organics in the way that Viking was looking for them. So we need to go back and look for organics in a different way that doesn't involve heating them up and therefore kind of destroying them with just the chemistry of the soil. So again, it's a very tantalising discovery. It's a reanalysis of something we discovered just 30 years ago. And this is why the new probes to Mars, Curiosity, that NASA is sending the next year, and then ExoMars, which is a European Space Agency mission due for launch in 2018, hopefully these will start answering these questions that have been left open for the last 30 years.
Are the conditions that we're looking at on Europa quite different?
So actually, some people tell you, and I can see a lot of sense in this, that Europa is a far better bet for life, at least active life now, than even Mars is. And as I say, we've discovered, we're not seen, but we know it's there from kind of indirect measurements, that there's this very deep liquid water ocean beneath the icy shell of Europa, that this icy moon of Jupiter has more liquid water in it than all the seas and lakes and rivers and oceans the whole of the Earth put together. So if we can get into that deep, dark, alien ocean, if we can land on the surface of Europa and then drill or melt away through this icy shell and get into that ocean to explore, there might be something very exciting waiting for this. Not just, kind of hardy life just clinging on by its fingertips like the surface of Mars might be able to support, but active ecosystems, the kind of things we find around black smokers on Earth. But this is a decade away. It's going to be very difficult to land something on Europa, drill through kilometres of solid, hard frozen ice, and then find something in a moon-sized ocean.
For the last portion of the show, then, let's move considerably further out. There's a lot of what's called exoplanets now being discovered. The last few years have seen an absolute sort of explosion in the number of planets outside of our solar system that have been discovered. So, again, let's perhaps talk about what sort of conditions on a sort of planetary-wide, on a sort of solar system-wide scale do we need to look for in looking for those planets to suggest that those planets might harbour life?
The first thing that people, astrobiologists, look for a habitable planet is one that's the right distance from its star. It's in this kind of sweet spot from its sun, where it's not too hot, not too cold, but just right. It's in what's known as the Goldilocks zone, or habitable zone of its star. And it's the right temperature for liquid water and oceans and the possibility of life. And excitingly, just a couple of weeks ago, the discovery was announced of the first Goldilocks planet beyond the Earth, beyond our solar system. And this is a planet with a dreary name. It's called Gliese 581G. It's what happens when astronomers give names to stuff. But this really boringly named planet is incredibly exciting because it's one of the smallest planets we've discovered beyond our solar system. It's about three times bigger than the Earth, we think. And it orbits smack in this Goldilocks zone around its star. So as far as we know, but that is all we know, as far as we know, it's got the right conditions, right temperature for liquid water on the surface, and the best chance for life beyond our solar system on a planet we've discovered so far.
What distance are we talking about? Where is this star in relation?
Well, this star is 20 light years from the Earth. It really is one of our next door neighbours. In terms of galactic scale, it's very, very close to us. And the planet orbits its star actually very, very closely as well. Its entire year lasts only 13 Earth days, because the kind of star it orbits is what's known as a red dwarf, after the sci-fi comedy series is. It's a smaller, cooler, redder star than our sun. And so to get the right kind of warmth from the campfire of this kind of star, you have to orbit a bit closer in. So it's snuggling very closely to its star, but within the habitable zone of this M-class dwarf.
We should probably just point out there that the comedy series was named after the star.
Yes, not vice versa.
So you actually, it's interesting, if we got, yes, just very quickly, you talk about the possibility of red dwarf stars as a possibility of places where we could find sort of a habitable life orbiting around them in the book, but it's like...
On one hand, red dwarfs are really exciting. They're the most populous kind of star in our galaxy. There's 10 times more red dwarfs than there are our kind of sun, solar type stars. But they're kind of troublesome. That they're smaller and cooler, so you have to orbit them more closely. And this presents lots of problems for planets, so for life on these planets, that you might have lots of flares kind of licking the planet with radiation, or the planet would become tidally locked, so it always shows the same face to the star, and you get big climactic problems. So, again, this is one of the things we're trying to nail down and an answer now.
Okay, well, we're out of time. We could easily have carried on about this for another half hour. So, Lewis, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.